Chapter 21. Lance and Pat wandered round the well-kept grounds surrounding Yew Tree Lodge.
"I hope I'm not hurting your feelings, Lance," Pat murmured, "if I say this is quite the nastiest garden I've been in."
"It won't hurt my feelings," said Lance. "Is it? Really, I don't know. It seems to have three gardeners working on it very industriously."
Pat said, "Probably that's what's wrong with it. No expense spared, no signs of individual taste. All the right rhododendrons and all the right bedding out, done in the proper season, I expect."
"Well, what would you put in an English garden, Pat, if you had one?"
"My garden," said Pat, "would have hollyhocks, larkspurs and Canterbury bells, no bedding out, and none of these horrible yews." She glanced up at the dark yew hedges disparagingly.
"Association of ideas," said Lance easily.
"There's something awfully frightening about a poisoner," said Pat. "I mean, it must be a horrid, brooding, revengeful mind."
"So that's how you see it. Funny, I just think of it as businesslike and cold-blooded."
"I suppose one could look at it that way," she resumed with a slight shiver. "All the same, to do three murders. Whoever did it must be mad."
"Yes," said Lance in a low voice. "I'm afraid so."
Then, breaking out sharply, he said, "For God's sake, Pat, do go away from here. Go back to London. Go down to Devonshire or up to the Lakes. Go to Stratford-on-Avon or go and look at the Norfolk Broads.
The police wouldn't mind your going. You had nothing to do with this. You were in Paris when the old man was killed and in London when the other two died. I tell you, it worries me to death to have you here."
Pat paused a moment before saying quietly, "You know who it is, don't you?"
"No, I don't."
"But you think you know. That's why you're frightened for me. I wish you'd tell me."
"I can't tell you. I don't know anything. But I wish to God you'd go away from here."
"Darling," said Pat, "I'm not going. I'm staying here, for better, for worse. That's how I feel about it."
She added with a sudden catch in her voice, "Only, with me, it's always for worse."
"What on earth do you mean, Pat?"
"I bring bad luck, that's what I mean. I bring bad luck to anybody I come in contact with."
"My dear, adorable nitwit, you haven't brought bad luck to me. Look how, after I married you, the old man sent for me to come home and make friends with him."
"Yes, and what happened when you did come home? I tell you, I'm unlucky to people."
"Look here, my sweet, you've got a thing about all this. It's superstition, pure and simple."
"I can't help it. Some people do bring bad luck. I'm one of them."
Lance took her by the shoulders and shook her violently. "You're my Pat, and to be married to you is the greatest luck in the world, so get that into your silly head."
Then, calming down, he said in a more sober voice, "But seriously, Pat, do be very careful. If there is someone unhinged round here, I don't want you to be the one who stops the bullet or drinks the henbane."
"Or drinks the henbane, as you say." "When I'm not around, stick to that old lady. What's her name? Marple. Why do you think Aunt Effie asked her to stay here?"
"Goodness knows why Aunt Effie does anything. Lance, how long are we going to stay here?"
Lance shrugged his shoulders. "Difficult to say."
"I don't think," said Pat, "that we're really awfully welcome." She hesitated as she spoke the words. "The house belongs to your brother now, I suppose. He doesn't really want us here, does he?"
Lance chuckled suddenly. "Not he, but he's got to stick us for the present, at any rate."
"And afterwards? What are we going to do, Lance? Are we going back to East Africa, or what?"
"Is that what you'd like to do, Pat?"
She nodded vigorously.
"That's lucky," said Lance, "because it's what I'd like to do, too. I don't take much to this country nowadays."
Pat's face brightened. "How lovely! From what you said the other day, I was afraid you might want to stop here."
A devilish glint appeared in Lance's eyes.
"You ought to hold your tongue about our plans, Pat," he said. "I have it in my mind to twist dear brother Percival's tail a bit."
"Oh, Lance, do be careful."
"I'll be careful, my sweet. But I don't see why old Percy should get away with everything."
With her head a little on one side, looking like an amiable cockatoo, Miss Marple sat in the large drawing-room, listening to Mrs. Percival Fortescue. Miss Marple looked particularly incongruous in the drawing-room. Her light, spare figure was alien to the vast brocaded sofa in which she sat, with its many hued cushions strewn around her. Miss Marple sat very upright, because she had been taught to use a backboard as a girl and not to loll. In a large armchair beside her, dressed in elaborate black, was Mrs. Percival, talking away volubly at 19 to the dozen. "Exactly," thought Miss Marple, "like poor Mrs. Emmett, the bank manager's wife." She remembered how, one day, Mrs. Emmett had come to call and talk about the selling arrangements for Poppy Day, and how, after the preliminary business had been settled, Mrs. Emmett had suddenly begun to talk and talk and talk. Mrs. Emmett occupied rather a difficult position in St. Mary Mead. She did not belong to the old guard of ladies in reduced circumstances who lived in neat houses round the church and knew intimately all the ramifications of the county families, even though they might not be strictly county themselves. Mr. Emmett, the bank manager, had undeniably married beneath him, and the result was that his wife was in a position of great loneliness, since she could not, of course, associate with the wives of tradespeople. Snobbery here raised its hideous head and marooned Mrs. Emmett on a permanent island of loneliness. The necessity to talk grew upon Mrs. Emmett, and on that particular day it had burst its bounds, and Miss Marple had received the full flood of the torrent. She had been sorry for Mrs. Emmett then, and today she was rather sorry for Mrs. Percival Fortescue. Mrs. Percival had had a lot of grievances to bear, and the relief of airing them to a more or less total stranger was enormous.
"Of course, I never want to complain," said Mrs. Percival. "I've never been of the complaining kind. What I always say is that one must put up with things. What can't be cured must be endured, and I'm sure I've never said a word to anyone. It's really difficult to know whom I could have spoken to. In some ways one is very isolated here. Very isolated. It's very convenient, of course, and a great saving of expense to have our own set of rooms in this house, but of course it's not at all like having a place of your own. I'm sure you agree."
Miss Marple said she agreed.
"Fortunately, our new house is almost ready to move into. It is a question really of getting the painters and decorators out. These men are so slow. My husband, of course, has been quite satisfied living here. But then it's different for a man. That's what I always say. It's so different for a man. Don't you agree?"
Miss Marple agreed that it was very different for a man. She could say this without a qualm, as it was what she really believed. The gentlemen were, in Miss Marple's mind, in a totally different category from her own sex. They required 2 eggs plus bacon for breakfast, 3 good nourishing meals a day, and were never to be contradicted or argued with before dinner. Mrs. Percival went on.
"My husband, you see, is away all day in the city. When he comes home, he's just tired and wants to sit down and read. But I, on the contrary, am alone here all day with no congenial company at all. I've been perfectly comfortable and all that. Excellent food. But what I do feel one needs is a really pleasant social circle. The people round here are really not my kind. Part of them are what I call a flashy bridge-playing lot. Not nice bridge. I like a hand of bridge myself as well as anyone. But, of course, they're all very rich down here. They play for enormously high stakes, and there's a great deal of drinking. In fact, the sort of life that I call really fast society.
Then, of course, there's a sprinkling of, well, you can only call them old pussies, who love to pot around with a trowel and do gardening. Miss Marple looked slightly guilty, since she was herself an inveterate gardener.
I don't want to say anything against the dead, resumed Mrs. Percy rapidly, but there's no doubt about it. Mr. Fortescue, my father-in-law, I mean, made a very foolish second marriage. Well, I can't call her my mother-in-law. She was the same age as I am. The real truth of it is, she was man-mad. Absolutely man-mad. And the way she spent money... My father-in-law was an absolute fool about her. Didn't care what bills she ran up. It vexed Percy very much. Very much indeed. Percy is always so careful about money matters. He hates waste. And then, what with Mr. Fortescue being so peculiar and so bad-tempered, flashing out in these terrible rages, spending money like water, backing wildcat schemes, well, it wasn't at all nice.
Miss Marple ventured upon making a remark. That must have worried your husband, too.
Oh, yes, it did. For the last year, Percy's been very worried indeed. It's really made him quite different. His manner, you know, changed, even towards me. Sometimes when I talked to him, he used not to answer.
Mrs. Percy sighed, then went on,
Then Elaine, my sister-in-law, you know, she's a very odd sort of girl. Very out of doors and all that. Not exactly unfriendly, but not sympathetic, you know. She never wanted to go up to London to shop, or go to a matinee, or anything of that kind. She wasn't even interested in clothes.
Mrs. Percival sighed again, and murmured,
But of course I don't want to complain in any way.
A qualm of compunction came over her. She said hurriedly,
You must think it most odd talking to you like this when you are a comparative stranger. But really, what with all the strain and shock, I think really it's the shock that matters most. Delayed shock. I feel so nervous, you know, that I really... Well, I really must speak to someone. You remind me so much of a dear old lady, Miss Trefusis James. She fractured her femur when she was 75. It was a very long business nursing her, and we became great friends. She gave me a fox fur cape when I left, and I did think it was kind of her.
I know just how you feel, said Miss Marple. And this again was true. Mrs. Percival's husband was obviously bored by her, and paid very little attention to her, and the poor woman had managed to make no local friends. Running up to London and shopping, matinees, and a luxurious house to live in did not make up for the lack of humanity in her relations with her husband's family.
"I hope it's not rude of me to say so," said Miss Marple, in a gentle old lady's voice. "But I really feel that the late Mr. Fortescue cannot have been a very nice man."
"He wasn't," said his daughter-in-law. "Quite frankly, my dear, between you and me, he was a detestable old man. I don't wonder, I really don't, that someone put him out of the way."
"You've no idea at all who..."
began Miss Marple, and broke off.
Oh, dear, perhaps this is a question I should not ask. Not even an idea who it might have been? Oh, I think it was that horrible man, Crump, said Mrs. Percival. I've always disliked him very much. He's got a manner. Not really rude, you know, but yet it is rude. Impertinent, that's more it.
Still, there would have to be a motive, I suppose.
I really don't know that that sort of person requires much motive. I dare say Mr. Fortescue ticked him off about something, and I'd rather suspect that sometimes he drinks too much. But what I really think is that he's a bit unbalanced, you know. Like that footman or butler, whoever it was, who went round the house shooting everybody. Of course, to be quite honest with you, I did suspect that it was Adele who poisoned Mr. Fortescue. But now, of course, one can't suspect that, since she's been poisoned herself.
She may have accused Crump, you know. And then he lost his head and perhaps managed to put something in the sandwiches, and Gladys saw him do it, and so he killed her too. I think it's really dangerous having him in the house at all. Oh, dear, I wish I could get away, but I suppose these horrible policemen won't let one do anything of the kind.
She leant forward impulsively and put a plump hand on Miss Marple's arm.
Sometimes I feel I must get away, that if it doesn't all stop soon, I shall actually run away.
She leant back, studying Miss Marple's face.
But perhaps that wouldn't be wise.
No, I don't think it would be very wise. The police could soon find you, you know.
Could they? Could they really? You think they're clever enough for that?
It is very foolish to underestimate the police. Inspector Neil strikes me as a particularly intelligent man.
Oh, I thought he was rather stupid.
Miss Marple shook her head.
I can't help feeling...
Jennifer Fortescue hesitated.
That it's dangerous to stay here.
Dangerous? For you, you mean?
Yes. Well, yes.
Because of something you know? Mrs. Percival seemed to take breath.
Oh, no, of course. I don't know anything. What should I know? It's just that I'm nervous. That man, Crump.
But it was not, Miss Marple thought, of Crump that Mrs. Percival Fortescue was thinking, watching the clenching and unclenching of Jennifer's hands. Miss Marple thought that for some reason Jennifer Fortescue was very badly frightened indeed. Chapter 22. It was growing dark. Miss Marple had taken her knitting over to the window in the library. Looking out of the glass pane, she saw Pat Fortescue walking up and down the terrace outside. Miss Marple unlatched the window and called through it.
"Come in, my dear. Do come in. I'm sure it's much too cold and damp for you to be out there without a coat on."
Pat obeyed the summons. She came in and shut the window and turned on two of the lamps.
"Yes," she said. "It's not a very nice afternoon."
She sat down on the sofa by Miss Marple.
"What are you knitting?"
"Oh, just a little matinée coat, dear, for a baby, you know. I always say young mothers can't have too many matinée coats for their babies. It's the second size. I always knit the second size. Babies so soon grow out of the first size."
Pat stretched out long legs towards the fire.
"It's nice in here today," she said, "with the fire and the lamps and new knitting things for babies. It all seems cosy and homely and as England ought to be."
"It's as England is," said Miss Marple. "There are not so many yew tree lodges, my dear."
"I think that's a good thing," said Pat. "I don't believe this was ever a happy house. I don't believe anybody was ever happy in it, in spite of all the money they spent and the things they had."
"No," Miss Marple agreed. "I shouldn't say it had been a happy house."
"I suppose Adele may have been happy," said Pat. "I never met her, of course, so I don't know. But Jennifer is pretty miserable, and Elaine's been eating her heart out over a young man who she probably knows in her heart of hearts doesn't care for her. Oh, how I want to get away from here."
She looked at Miss Marple and smiled suddenly.
"Do you know," she said, "that Lance told me to stick as close to you as I could? He seemed to think I should be safe that way."
"Your husband's no fool," said Miss Marple.
"No, Lance isn't a fool. At least, he is in some ways. But I wish he'd tell me exactly what he's afraid of. One thing seems clear enough. Somebody in this house is mad. And madness is always frightening, because you don't know how mad people's minds will work. You don't know what they'll do next."
"My poor child," said Miss Marple.
"Oh, I'm all right, really. I ought to be tough enough by now. Miss Marple said gently, You've had a good deal of unhappiness, haven't you, my dear?
Oh, I've had some very good times, too. I had a lovely childhood in Ireland, riding, hunting, and a great big bare, draughty house with lots and lots of sun in it. If you've had a happy childhood, nobody can take that away from you, can they?
It was afterwards, when I grew up, that things seemed always to go wrong.
To begin with, I suppose it was the war.
Your husband was a fighter pilot, wasn't he?
Yes. We'd only been married a month when Don was shot down.
She stared ahead of her into the fire.
I thought at first I wanted to die too. It seemed so unfair, so cruel. And yet, in the end, I almost began to see that it had been the best thing. Don was wonderful in the war, brave and reckless and gay. He had all the qualities that are needed, wanted, in a war. But I don't believe somehow peace would have suited him. He had a kind of, oh, how shall I put it, arrogant insubordination. He wouldn't have fitted in or settled down. He'd have fought against things. He was, well, antisocial in a way. No, he wouldn't have fitted in.
It's wise of you to see that, my dear. Miss Marple bent over her knitting, picked up a stitch, counted under her breath.
3 plain, 2 purl, slip 1, knit 2 together.
And then said aloud, And your second husband, my dear?
Freddy. Freddy shot himself.
Oh, dear. How very sad.
What a tragedy.
We were very happy together, said Pat.
I began to realise about 2 years ago, after we were married, that Freddy wasn't, well, wasn't always straight. I began to find out the sort of things that were going on. But it didn't seem to matter between us two, that is, because, you see, Freddy loved me and I loved him. I tried not to know what was going on. That was cowardly of me, I suppose, but I couldn't have changed him, you know. You can't change people.
No, said Miss Marple, you can't change people.
I'd taken him and loved him and married him for what he was, and I sort of felt that I just had to put up with it. Then things went wrong, and he couldn't face it, and he shot himself. After he died, I went out to Kenya to stay with some friends there. I couldn't stop on in England and go on meeting all the old crowd that knew about it all. And out in Kenya, I met Lance.
Her face changed and softened. She went on looking into the fire, and Miss Marple looked at her. Presently, Pat turned her head and said,
Tell me, Miss Marple, what do you really think of Percival?
Well, I have not seen very much of him, just at breakfast usually, that's all. I don't think he very much likes my being here. Pat laughed suddenly.
He's mean, you know. Terribly mean about money.
Lance says he always was. Jennifer complains of it too. Goes over the housekeeping accounts with Miss Dove, complaining of every item. But Miss Dove manages to hold her own. She's rather a wonderful person, don't you think so?
Yes, indeed. She reminds me of Mrs. Latimer in my own village, St. Mary Mead. She ran the women's voluntary services, you know, and the girl guides, and indeed she ran practically everything there. It wasn't for quite 5 years that we discovered that... Oh, but I mustn't gossip. Nothing is more boring than people talking to you about places and people whom you've never seen and know nothing about. You must forgive me, my dear.
Is St. Mary Mead a very nice village?
Well, I don't quite know what you would call a nice village, my dear. It's quite a pretty village. There are some nice people living in it, and some extremely unpleasant people as well. Very curious things go on there, just as in any other village. Human nature is much the same everywhere, is it not?
You go up and see Miss Ramsbottom a good deal, don't you? Said Pat.
Now she really frightens me.
Frightens you?
Why?
Because I think she's crazy. I think she's got religious mania. You don't think she could be really mad, do you?
In what way, mad?
Oh, you know what I mean, Miss Marple, well enough. She sits up there and never goes out and broods about sin. Well, she might have felt in the end that it was her mission in life to execute judgment.
Is that what your husband thinks?
I don't know what Lance thinks. He won't tell me. But I'm quite sure of one thing, that he believes that it's someone who's mad and it's someone in the family. Well, Percival's sane enough, I should say. Jennifer's just stupid and rather pathetic. She's a bit nervy, but that's all. And Elaine is one of those queer, tempestuous, tense girls. She's desperately in love with this young man of hers, and she'll never admit to herself for a moment that he's marrying her for her money.
You think he is marrying her for money?
Yes, I do. Don't you think so?
I should say so, quite certainly, said Miss Marple.
Like young Ellis, who married Marion Bates, the rich ironmonger's daughter. She was a very plain girl and absolutely besotted about him. However, it turned out quite well. People like young Ellis and this Gerald Wright are only really disagreeable when they've married a poor girl for love. They're so annoyed with themselves for doing it that they take it out of the girl. But if they marry a rich girl, they continue to respect her.
I don't see, went on Pat, frowning, how it can be anyone from outside.
And so that accounts for the atmosphere that is here. Everyone watching everybody else. Only something's got to happen soon.
There won't be any more deaths, said Miss Marple. At least I shouldn't think so.
You can't be sure of that.
Well, as a matter of fact, I am fairly sure. The murderer's accomplished his purpose, you see.
His?
Well, his or her. One says his for convenience.
You say his or her purpose. What sort of purpose?
Miss Marple shook her head. She was not yet quite sure herself. Chapter 23. Once again, Miss Summers had just made tea in the typist's room, and once again the kettle had not been boiling when Miss Summers poured the water onto the tea. History repeats itself. Miss Griffith, accepting her cup, thought to herself, "I really must speak to Mr. Percival about Summers. I'm sure we can do better. But with all this terrible business going on, one doesn't like to bother him over office details." As so often before, Miss Griffith said sharply, "Water not boiling again, Summers!" Miss Summers, going pink, replied in her usual formula, "Oh, dear, I was sure it was boiling this time." Further developments on the same line were interrupted by the entrance of Lance Fortescue. He looked round him somewhat vaguely, and Miss Griffith, jumping up, came forward to meet him. "Mr. Lance!" she exclaimed. He swung round towards her, and his face lit up in a smile.
"Hello! Why, it's Miss Griffith!"
Miss Griffith was delighted. 11 years since he had seen her, and he knew her name. She said in a confused voice, "Fancy your remembering!" And Lance said easily, with all his charm to the fore, "Of course I remember." A flicker of excitement was running round the typist's room. Miss Summers' troubles over the tea were forgotten. She was gaping at Lance with her mouth slightly open. Miss Bell gazed eagerly over the top of her typewriter, and Miss Chase unobtrusively drew out her compact and powdered her nose. Lance Fortescue looked round him.
"So, everything's still going on just the same here," he said.
"Not many changes, Mr. Lance. How brown you look, and how well! I suppose you must have had a very interesting life abroad."
"You could call it that," said Lance. "But perhaps I'm now going to try and have an interesting life in London."
"You're coming back here to the office?"
"Maybe."
"Oh, but how delightful!"
"You'll find me very rusty," said Lance.
You'll have to show me all the ropes, Miss Griffith.
Miss Griffith laughed delightedly.
It will be very nice to have you back, Mr. Lance. Very nice indeed.
Lance threw her an appreciative glance. That's sweet of you, he said. That's very sweet of you.
We never believed, none of us thought. Miss Griffith broke off and flushed.
Lance patted her on the arm. You didn't believe the devil was as black as he was painted? Well, perhaps he wasn't. But that's all old history now. There's no good going back over it. The future's the thing. He added, Is my brother here?
He's in the inner office, I think.
Lance nodded easily and passed on. In the anteroom to the inner sanctum, a hard-faced woman of middle age rose behind a desk and said forbiddingly,
Your name and business, please.
Lance looked at her doubtfully. Are you Miss Grosvenor? He asked. Miss Grosvenor had been described to him as a glamorous blonde. She had indeed appeared so in the pictures that had been published in the newspapers reporting the inquest on Rex Fortescue. This surely could not be Miss Grosvenor.
Miss Grosvenor left last week. I am Mrs. Hardcastle, Mr. Percival Fortescue's personal secretary.
How like old Percy, thought Lance, to get rid of a glamorous blonde and take on a Gorgon instead. I wonder why. Was it safety, or was it because this one comes cheaper? Aloud, he said easily, I'm Lancelot Fortescue. You haven't met me yet.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Mr. Lancelot, Mrs. Hardcastle apologized. This is the first time, I think, you've been to the office.
The first time, but not the last, said Lance, smiling. He crossed the room and opened the door of what had been his father's private office. Somewhat to his surprise, it was not Percival who was sitting behind the desk there, but Inspector Neale. Inspector Neale looked up from a large wad of papers which he was sorting and nodded his head.
Good morning, Mr. Fortescue. You've come to take up your duties, I suppose.
So you've heard I decided to come into the firm.
Your brother told me so.
He did he?
With enthusiasm?
Inspector Neale endeavoured to conceal a smile.
The enthusiasm was not marked, he said gravely.
Poor Percy, commented Lance. Inspector Neale looked at him curiously.
Are you really going to become a city man?
You don't think it's likely, Inspector Neale?
It doesn't seem quite in character, Mr. Fortescue.
Why not? I'm my father's son.
And your mother's.
Lance shook his head.
You haven't got anything there, Inspector. My mother was a Victorian romantic. Her favourite reading was The Idylls of the King, as indeed you may have deduced from our curious Christian names. She was an invalid and always, I should imagine, out of touch with reality. I'm not like that at all. I have no sentiment, very little sense of romance, and I'm a realist, first and last.
People aren't always what they think themselves to be, Inspector Neale pointed out.
No, I suppose that's true, said Lance.
He sat down in a chair and stretched his long legs out in his own characteristic fashion. He was smiling to himself.
Then he said unexpectedly, You're shrewder than my brother, Inspector.
In what way, Mr. Fortescue?
I've put the wind up Percy, all right. He thinks I'm all set for the city life. He thinks he's going to have my fingers fiddling about in his pie. He thinks I'll launch out and spend the firm's money and try and embroil him in wildcat schemes. It would be almost worth doing just for the fun of it. Almost, but not quite. I couldn't really stand an office life, Inspector. I like the open air and some possibilities of adventure. I'd stifle in a place like this.
He added quickly,
This is off the record, mind. Don't give me away to Percy, will you?
I don't suppose the subject will arise, Mr. Fortescue.
I must have my bit of fun with Percy, said Lance. I want to make him sweat a bit. I've got to get a bit of my own back.
That's rather a curious phrase, Mr. Fortescue, said Neale. Your own back? For what?
Lance shrugged his shoulders. Oh, it's old history now. Not worth going back over. There was a little matter of a cheque, I understand, in the past, Would that be what you're referring to?
How much you know, Inspector?
There was no question of prosecution, I understand, said Neil. Your father wouldn't have done that.
No, he just kicked me out, that's all.
Inspector Neil eyed him speculatively, but it was not Lance Fortescue of whom he was thinking, but of Percival, the honest, industrious, parsimonious Percival. It seemed to him that wherever he got in the case, he was always coming up against the enigma of Percival Fortescue, a man of whom everybody knew the outer aspects, but whose inner personality was much harder to gauge. One would have said from observing him, a somewhat colourless and insignificant character, a man who had been very much under his father's thumb. Percy Prim, in fact, as the AC had once said. Neil was trying now, through Lance, to get a closer appreciation of Percival's personality. He murmured in a tentative manner, "Your brother seems always to have been very much, well, how shall I put it, under your father's thumb." "I wonder." Lance seemed definitely to be considering the point.
"I wonder. Yes, that would be the effect, I think, given, but I'm not sure that it was really the truth. It's astonishing, you know, when I look back through life, to see how Percy always got his own way without seeming to do so, if you know what I mean."
Yes, Inspector Neil thought, it was indeed astonishing. He sorted through the papers in front of him, fished out a letter, and shoved it across the desk towards Lance.
"This is a letter you wrote last August, isn't it, Mr. Fortescue?"
Lance took it, glanced at it, and returned it.
"Yes," he said. "I wrote it after I got back to Kenya last summer." "Dad kept it, did he? Where was it? Here in the office?"
"No, Mr. Fortescue. It was among your father's papers in Yew Tree Lodge." The inspector considered it speculatively as it lay on the desk in front of him.
It was not a long letter. "Dear Dad, I've talked things over with Pat, and I agree to your proposition. It will take me a little time to get things fixed up here, say about the end of October or beginning of November. I'll let you know nearer the time. I hope we'll pull together better than we used to do. Anyway, I'll do my best. I can't say more. Look after yourself. Yours, Lance."
"Where did you address this letter, Mr. Fortescue? To the office or Yew Tree Lodge?" Lance frowned in an effort of recollection.
"It's difficult. I can't remember. You see, it's almost 3 months now."
"The office, I think?"
"Yes, I'm almost sure. Here, to the office."
He paused a moment before asking, with frank curiosity, "Why?"
"I wondered," said Inspector Neil. "Your father did not put it in the file here among his private papers. He took it back with him to Yew Tree Lodge, and I found it in his desk there. I wondered why he should have done that."
Lance laughed.
"To keep it out of Percy's way, I suppose."
"Yes," said Inspector Neil. "It would seem so. Your brother, then, had access to your father's private papers here?"
"Well," Lance hesitated and frowned, "not exactly. I mean, I suppose he could have looked through them at any time, if he liked, but he wouldn't be..."
Inspector Neil finished the sentence for him.
"Wouldn't be supposed to do so?"
Lance grinned broadly.
"That's right. Frankly, it would have been snooping. But Percy, I should imagine, always did snoop."
Inspector Neil nodded. He also thought it probable that Percival Fortescue snooped. It would be in keeping with what the inspector was beginning to learn of his character.
"And talk of the devil," murmured Lance,
as at that moment the door opened and Percival Fortescue came in. About to speak to the inspector, he stopped, frowning as he saw Lance.
"Hello," he said. "You here. You didn't tell me you were coming here today."
"I felt a kind of zeal for work coming over me," said Lance. "So here I am, ready to make myself useful. What do you want me to do?"
Percival said testily,
"Nothing at present, nothing at all. We shall have to come to some kind of arrangement as to what side of the business you're going to look after. We shall have to arrange an office for you.
Lance inquired with a grin. By the way, why did you get rid of glamorous Grosvenor, old boy, and replace her by horse-faced Hetty out there?
Really, Lance?
Percival protested sharply. Definitely a change for the worse, said Lance. I've been looking forward to the glamorous Grosvenor. Why did you sack her? Thought she knew a bit too much?
Of course not. What an idea!
Percy spoke angrily, a flush mounting his pale face. He turned to the inspector.
You mustn't pay any attention to my brother, he said coldly. He has a rather peculiar sense of humour.
He added,
I never had a very high opinion of Miss Grosvenor's intelligence. Mrs. Hardcastle has excellent references and is most capable, besides being very moderate in her terms.
Very moderate in her terms, murmured Lance, casting his eyes towards the ceiling.
You know, Percy, I don't really approve of skimping over the office personnel. By the way, considering how loyally the staff has stood by us during these last tragic weeks, don't you think we ought to raise their salaries all round?
Certainly not, snapped Percival Fortescue. Quite uncalled for and unnecessary.
Inspector Neil noticed the gleam of devilry in Lance's eyes. Percival, however, was far too upset to notice it.
You always had the most extraordinarily extravagant ideas, he stuttered. In the state in which this firm has been left, economy is our only hope.
Inspector Neil coughed apologetically. That's one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Mr. Fortescue, he said to Percival.
Yes, Inspector.
Percival switched his attention to Neil. I want to put certain suggestions before you, Mr. Fortescue. I understand that for the past 6 months, or longer, possibly a year, your father's general behaviour and conduct have been a source of increasing anxiety to you.
He wasn't well, said Percival with finality. He certainly wasn't at all well.
You tried to induce him to see a doctor, but you failed. He refused categorically.
That is so.
May I ask you if you suspected that your father was suffering from what is familiarly referred to as GPI, General Paralysis of the Insane, a condition with signs of megalomania and irritability, which terminates sooner or later in hopeless insanity?
Percival looked surprised. It is remarkably astute of you, Inspector. That is exactly what I did fear. That is why I was so anxious for my father to submit to medical treatment.
Neil went on. In the meantime, until you could persuade your father to do that, he was capable of causing great havoc to the business?
He certainly was, Percival agreed.
A very unfortunate state of affairs, said the inspector.
Quite terrible. No one knows the anxiety I have been through.
Neil said gently, from the business point of view, your father's death was an extremely fortunate circumstance.
Percival said sharply, you can hardly think I would regard my father's death in that light.
It is not a question of how you regard it, Mr. Fortescue. I'm speaking merely of a question of fact. Your father died before his finances were completely on the rocks.
Percival said impatiently, yes, yes, as a matter of actual fact, you are right.
It was a fortunate occurrence for your whole family, since they are dependent on this business.
Yes, but really, Inspector, I don't see what you're driving at.
Percival broke off. Oh, I'm not driving at anything, Mr. Fortescue, said Neil. I just like getting my facts straight. Now, there's another thing. I understood you to say that you'd had no communication of any kind with your brother here since he left England many years ago.
Quite so, said Percival.
Yes, but it isn't quite so, is it, Mr. Fortescue? I mean that last summer, when you were so worried about your father's health, you actually wrote to your brother in Africa, told him of your anxiety about your father's behaviour. You wanted, I think, your brother to combine with you in getting your father medically examined and put under restraint if necessary.
I really, I don't see...
Percival was badly shaken. That is so, isn't it, Mr. Fortescue?
Well, actually, I thought it only right. After all, Lancelot was a junior partner.
Inspector Neil transferred his gaze to Lance. Lance was grinning. You received that letter? Inspector Neil asked. Lance Fortescue nodded. What did you reply to it? Lance's grin widened. I tell Percy to go and boil his head and to let the old man alone. I said the old man probably knew what he was doing quite well. Inspector Neil's gaze went back again to Percival. Were those the terms of your brother's answer?
I suppose roughly, yes. Far more offensively couched, however.
I thought the inspector had better have a bowdlerised version, said Lance. He went on, Frankly, Inspector Neil, that is one of the reasons why, when I got a letter from my father, I came home to see for myself what I thought. In the short interview I had with my father, frankly, I couldn't see anything much wrong with him. He was slightly excitable, that was all. He appeared to me perfectly capable of managing his own affairs. Anyway, after I got back to Africa and had talked things over with Pat, I decided that I'd come home and, what shall we say, see fair play. He shot a glance at Percival as he spoke.
I object, said Percival Fortescue. I object strongly to what you are suggesting. I was not intending to victimise my father. I was concerned for his health. I admit that I was also concerned.
He paused. Lance filled the pause quickly. You are also concerned for your pocket, eh? For Percy's little pocket. He got up, and all of a sudden his manner changed. All right, Percy, I'm through. I was going to string you along a bit by pretending to work here. I wasn't going to let you have things all your own sweet way. But I'm damned if I'm going on with it. Frankly, it makes me sick to be in the same room with you. You've always been a dirty, mean little skunk all your life, prying and snooping and lying and making trouble. I'll tell you another thing. I can't prove it, but I've always believed it was you who forged that check there was all a row about, that got me shot out of here. For one thing, it was a damn bad forgery, a forgery that drew attention to itself in letters a foot high. My record was too bad for me to be able to protest effectively, but I often wondered that the old boy didn't realise that if I had forged his name, I could have made a much better job of it than that. Lance swept on, his voice rising. Well, Percy, I'm not going on with the silly game. I'm sick of this country and of the city. I'm sick of little men like you with their pinstripe trousers and their black coats and their mincing voices and their mean, shoddy financial deals. We'll share out as you suggested, and I'll get back with Pat to a different country, a country where there's room to breathe and move about. You can make your own list of securities. Keep the gilt-edged and conservative ones. Keep the safe 2% and 3% and 3.5%. Give me Father's latest wildcat speculations, as you call them. Most of them are probably duds, but I'll bet that one or two of them will pay better in the end than all your playing safe with 3% trustee stocks will do. Father was a shrewd old devil. He took chances, plenty of them. Some of those chances paid 5% and 6% and 700%. I'll back his judgment and his luck. As for you, you little worm! Lance advanced towards his brother, who retreated rapidly round the end of the desk towards Inspector Neil. All right, said Lance. I'm not going to touch you. You wanted me out of here, you're getting me out of here. You ought to be satisfied. He added as he strode towards the door. You can throw in the old Blackbird Mine concession too, if you like. If you've got the murdering Mackenzies on our trail, I'll draw them off to Africa. He added as he swung through the doorway. Revenge, after all these years, scarcely seems credible. But Inspector Neil seems to take it seriously, don't you, Inspector?
Nonsense, said Percival. Such a thing is impossible.
Ask him, said Lance. Ask him why he's making all these inquiries into blackbirds and rye in Father's pocket.
Gently stroking his upper lip, Inspector Neil said,
You remember the blackbirds last summer, Mr. Fortescue? There are certain grounds for inquiry.
Nonsense, said Percival again. Nobody's heard of the Mackenzies for years.
And yet, said Lance, I'd almost dare to swear that there's a Mackenzie in our midst. I rather imagine the inspector thinks so, too.
Inspector Neil caught up Lancelot Fortescue as the latter emerged into the street below. Lance grinned at him rather sheepishly.
I didn't mean to do that, he said, but I suddenly lost my temper. Oh, well, it would have come to the same before long. I'm meeting Pat at the Savoy. Are you coming my way, Inspector?
No, I'm returning to Baden Heath, but there's just something I'd like to ask you, Mr. Fortescue.
Yes?
When you came into the inner office and saw me there, you were surprised. Why?
Because I didn't expect to see you, I suppose. I thought I'd find Percy there.
You weren't told that he'd gone out?
Lance looked at him curiously.
No, they said he was in his office.
I see. Nobody knew he'd gone out. There's no second door out of the inner office, but there is a door leading straight into the corridor from the little antechamber. I suppose your brother went out that way.
But I'm surprised Mrs. Hardcastle didn't tell you so.
Lance laughed.
She'd probably been to collect her cup of tea.
Yes, yes, quite so.
Lance looked at him.
What's the idea, Inspector?
Just puzzling over a few little things.
That's all, Mr. Fortescue.
Chapter 24. In the train on the way down to Baden Heath, Inspector Neil had singularly little success doing the Times crossword. His mind was distracted by various possibilities. In the same way, he read the news with only half his brain taking it in. He read of an earthquake in Japan, of the discovery of uranium deposits in Tanganyika, of the body of a merchant seaman washed up near Southampton, and of the imminent strike among the dockers. He read of the latest victims of the cosh, and of a new drug that had achieved wonders in advanced cases of tuberculosis. All these items made a queer kind of pattern in the back of his mind. Presently, he returned to the crossword puzzle and was able to put down three clues in rapid succession. When he reached Yew Tree Lodge, he had come to a certain decision. He said to Sergeant Hay, "Where's that old lady? Is she still here?"
"Miss Marple? Oh, yes, she's here still. Great buddies with the old lady upstairs."
"I see." Neil paused for a moment and then said, "Where is she now? I'd like to see her." Miss Marple arrived in a few minutes' time, looking rather flushed and breathing fast.
"You want to see me, Inspector Neil? I do hope I haven't kept you waiting. Sergeant Hay couldn't find me at first. I was in the kitchen, talking to Mrs. Crump. I was congratulating her on her pastry and how light her hand is, and telling her how delicious the souffle was last night. I always think, you know, it's better to approach a subject gradually, don't you? At least I suppose it isn't so easy for you. You more or less have to come almost straight away to the questions you want to ask. But, of course, for an old lady like me, who has all the time in the world, as you might say, it's really expected of her that there should be a great deal of unnecessary talk. And the way to a cook's heart, as they say, is through her pastry."
"What you really wanted to talk to her about," said Inspector Neil, "was Gladys Martin."
Miss Marple nodded.
"Yes, Gladys. You see, Mrs. Crump could really tell me a lot about the girl. Not in connection with the murder, I don't mean that, but about her spirits lately, and the odd things she said. I don't mean odd in the sense of peculiar. I mean just the odds and ends of conversation."
"Did you find it helpful?" asked Inspector Neil.
"Yes," said Miss Marple. "I found it very helpful indeed. I really think, you know, that things are becoming very much clearer, don't you?"
"I do and I don't," said Inspector Neil.
Sergeant Hay, he noticed, had left the room. He was glad of it, because what he was about to do and say now was, to say the least of it, slightly unorthodox. "Look here, Miss Marple," he said. "I want to talk to you seriously."
"Yes, Inspector Neil?"
"In a way," said Inspector Neil, "you and I represent different points of view. I admit, Miss Marple, that I've heard something about you at the Yard." He said, "It seems you're fairly well known there."
"I don't know how it is," fluttered Miss Marple, "but I so often seem to get mixed up in things that are really no concern of mine. Crimes, I mean, and peculiar happenings."
"You've got a reputation," said Inspector Neil.
"Sir Henry Clithering, of course," said Miss Marple, "is a very old friend of mine."
"As I said before," Neil went on, "you and I represent opposite points of view. One might almost call them sanity and insanity." Miss Marple put her head a little on one side.
"Now, what exactly do you mean by that, I wonder, Inspector?"
"Well, Miss Marple, there's a sane way of looking at things. This murder benefits certain people. One person, I may say, in particular. The second murder benefits the same person. The third murder one might call a murder for safety."
"But which do you call the third murder?" Miss Marple asked.
Her eyes, a very bright china blue, looked shrewdly at the inspector. He nodded. "Yes, you've got something there, perhaps. You know, the other day, when the AC was speaking to me of these murders, something that he said seemed to me to be wrong, and that was it. I was thinking, of course, of the nursery rhyme. The king in his counting house, the queen in the parlour, and the maid hanging out the clothes."
"Exactly," said Miss Marple. "A sequence in that order. But actually, Gladys must have been murdered before Mrs. Fortescue, mustn't she?"
"I think so," said Neil. "I take it it's quite certainly so. Her body wasn't discovered till late that night, and of course it was difficult then to say exactly how long she'd been dead. But I think myself that she must almost certainly have been murdered round about 5 o'clock, because otherwise..."
Miss Marple cut in. "Because otherwise she would certainly have taken the second tray into the library."
"Quite so. She took one tray in with the tea on it. She brought the second tray into the hall, and then something happened. She saw something or she heard something. The question is what that something was. It might have been Dubois coming down the stairs from Mrs. Fortescue's room. It might have been Elaine Fortescue's young man, Gerald Wright, coming in at the side door. Whoever it was lured her away from the tea tray and out into the garden. And once that had happened, I don't see any possibility of her death being long delayed. It was cold out, and she was wearing only her thin uniform."
"Of course you're quite right," said Miss Marple. "I mean, it was never a case of the maid was in the garden hanging up the clothes. She wouldn't be hanging up clothes at that time of the evening, and she wouldn't go out to the clothesline without putting a coat on. That was all camouflage, like the clothes peg, to make the thing fit in with the rhyme."
"Exactly," said Inspector Neil. "Crazy. That's where I can't yet see eye to eye with you. I simply can't swallow this nursery rhyme business."
"But it fits, Inspector. You must agree it fits."
"It fits," said Neil heavily, "but all the same the sequence is wrong. I mean, the rhyme definitely suggests that the maid was the third murder, but we know that the queen was the third murder. Adele Fortescue was not killed until between 5:25 and 6:05. By then, Gladys must already have been dead."
"And that's all wrong, isn't it?" said Miss Marple. "All wrong for the nursery rhyme. That's very significant, isn't it?"
Inspector Neil shrugged his shoulders. "It's probably splitting hairs. The deaths fulfilled the conditions of the rhyme, and I suppose that's all that was needed. But I'm talking now as though I were on your side. I'm going to outline my side of the case now, Miss Marple. I'm washing out the blackbirds and the rye and all the rest of it. I'm going by sober facts and common sense and the reasons for which sane people do murders. First, the death of Rex Fortescue and whom his death benefits. Well, it benefits quite a lot of people, but most of all, it benefits his son, Percival. His son, Percival, wasn't at Yew Tree Lodge that morning. He couldn't have put poison in his father's coffee or in anything that he ate for breakfast. Or that's what we thought at first. Ah, Miss Marple's eyes brightened. So there was a method, was there? I've been thinking about it, you know, a good deal, and I've had several ideas, but of course no evidence or proof.
There's no harm in my letting you know, said Inspector Neil. Taxine was added to a new jar of marmalade. That jar of marmalade was placed on the breakfast table, and the top layer of it was eaten by Mr. Fortescue at breakfast. Later, that jar of marmalade was thrown out into the bushes, and a similar jar, with a similar amount taken out of it, was placed in the pantry. The jar in the bushes was found, and I've just had the result of the analysis. It shows definite evidence of taxine.
So that was it, murmured Miss Marple. So simple and easy to do.
Consolidated Investments, Neil went on, was in a bad way. If the firm had had to pay out £100,000 to Adele Fortescue under her husband's will, it would, I think, have crashed. If Mrs. Fortescue had survived her husband for a month, that money would have had to be paid out to her. She would have had no feeling for the firm or its difficulties. But she didn't survive her husband for a month. She died. And as a result of her death, the gainer was the residuary legatee of Rex Fortescue's will. In other words, Percival Fortescue again. Always Percival Fortescue, the inspector continued bitterly. And though he could have tampered with the marmalade, he couldn't have poisoned his stepmother or strangled Gladys. According to his secretary, he was in his city office at 5 o'clock that afternoon, and he didn't arrive back here until nearly 7.
That makes it very difficult, doesn't it? Said Miss Marple.
It makes it impossible, said Inspector Neil gloomily. In other words, Percival is out.
Abandoning restraint and prudence, he spoke with some bitterness, almost unaware of his listener.
Wherever I go, wherever I turn, I always come up against the same person, Percival Fortescue.
Yet it can't be Percival Fortescue.
Calming himself a little, he said, Oh, there are other possibilities, other people who had a perfectly good motive.
Mr. Dubois, of course, said Miss Marple sharply. And that young Mr. Wright. I do so agree with you, Inspector. Wherever there is a question of gain, one has to be very suspicious. The great thing to avoid is having in any way a trustful mind.
In spite of himself, Neil smiled. Always think the worst, eh? He asked.
It seemed a curious doctrine to be proceeding from this charming and fragile-looking old lady.
Oh, yes, said Miss Marple fervently. I always believe the worst. What is so sad is that one is usually justified in doing so.
All right, said Neil. Let's think the worst. Dubois could have done it. Gerald Wright could have done it. That is to say, if he'd been acting in collusion with Elaine Fortescue and she tampered with the marmalade. Mrs. Percival could have done it, I suppose. She was on the spot.
But none of the people I've mentioned tie up with the crazy angle. They don't tie up with blackbirds and pockets full of rye. That's your theory, and it may be that you're right. If so, it boils down to one person, doesn't it? Mrs. Mackenzie's in a mental home and has been for a good number of years. She hasn't been messing about with marmalade pots or putting cyanide in the afternoon tea. Her son, Donald, was killed at Dunkirk. That leaves the daughter, Ruby Mackenzie. And if your theory is correct, if this whole series of murders arises out of the old Blackbird Mine business, then Ruby Mackenzie must be here, in this house. and there's only one person that Ruby Mackenzie could be.
I think you know, said Miss Marple, that you're being a little too dogmatic.
Inspector Neil paid no attention. Just one person, he said grimly. He got up and went out of the room. Mary Dove was in her own sitting room. It was a small, rather austerely furnished room, but comfortable. When Inspector Neil tapped at the door, Mary Dove raised her head, which had been bent over a pile of tradesmen's books, and said in her clear voice, "Come in." The inspector entered.
"Do sit down, Inspector." Miss Dove indicated a chair. "Could you wait just one moment? The total of the fishmonger's account does not seem to be correct, and I must check it."
Inspector Neil sat in silence, watching her as she totted up the column. How wonderfully calm and self-possessed the girl was, he thought. He was intrigued, as so often before, by the personality that underlay that self-assured manner. He tried to trace in her features any resemblance to those of the woman he had talked to at the Pinewood Sanatorium. The colouring was not unlike, but he could detect no real facial resemblance. Presently, Mary Dove raised her head from her accounts and said,
"Yes, Inspector, what can I do for you?"
Inspector Neil said quietly, "You know, Miss Dove, there are certain very peculiar features about this case."
"Yes?"
"To begin with, there is the odd circumstance of the rye found in Mr. Fortescue's pocket."
"That was very extraordinary," Mary Dove agreed. "You know, I really cannot think of any explanation for that."
"Then there is the curious circumstance of the blackbirds. Those four blackbirds on Mr. Fortescue's desk last summer. And also the incident of the blackbirds being substituted for the veal and ham in the pie. You were here, I think, Miss Dove, at the time of both those occurrences."
"Yes, I was. I remember now. It was most upsetting. It seemed such a very purposeless, spiteful thing to do, especially at the time."
"Perhaps not entirely purposeless."
"What do you know, Miss Dove, about the Blackbird Mine?"
"I don't think I've ever heard of the Blackbird Mine." "Your name, you told me, is Mary Dove. Is that your real name, Miss Dove?"
Mary Dove raised her eyebrows.
Inspector Neil was almost sure that a wary expression had come into her blue eyes.
"What an extraordinary question, Inspector. Are you suggesting that my name is not Mary Dove?"
"That is exactly what I'm suggesting."
"I'm suggesting," said Neil pleasantly, "that your name is Ruby Mackenzie."
She stared at him. For a moment her face was entirely blank, with neither protest on it nor surprise. There was, Inspector Neil thought, a very definite effect of calculation. After a minute or two she said in a quiet, colourless voice,
"What do you expect me to say?"
"Please answer me. Is your name Ruby Mackenzie?"
"I have told you. My name is Mary Dove."
"Yes, but have you proof of that, Miss Dove?"
"What do you want to see? My birth certificate?"
"That might be helpful, or it might not. You might, I mean, be in possession of the birth certificate of a Mary Dove. That Mary Dove might be a friend of yours, or might be someone who had died."
"Yes, there are a lot of possibilities, aren't there?"
Amusement had crept back into Mary Dove's voice.
"It's really quite a dilemma for you, isn't it, Inspector?"
"They might possibly be able to recognise you at Pinewood Sanatorium," said Neil.
"Pinewood Sanatorium?"
Mary raised her eyebrows.
"What or where is Pinewood Sanatorium?"
"I think you know very well, Miss Dove."
"I assure you I am quite in the dark."
"And you deny categorically that you are Ruby Mackenzie?"
"I shouldn't really like to deny anything. I think you know, Inspector, that it's up to you to prove I am this Ruby Mackenzie, whoever she is."
There was definite amusement now in her blue eyes. Amusement and challenge. Looking him straight in the eyes, Mary Dove said,
"Yes, it's up to you, Inspector. Prove that I'm Ruby Mackenzie, if you can."
Chapter 25. "The old tabby's looking for you, sir," said Sergeant Hay in a conspiratorial whisper, as Inspector Neil descended the stairs. "It appears as how she's got a lot more to say to you."
"Helen damnation," said Inspector Neil.
"Yes, sir," said Sergeant Hay, not a muscle of his face moving. He was about to move away when Neil called him back. "Go over those notes given us by Miss Dove, Hay. Notes as to her former employment and situations. Check up on them. And, yes, there are just one or two other things that I would like to know. Put these inquiries in hand, will you?"
He jotted down a few lines on a sheet of paper and gave them to Sergeant Hay, who said,
"I'll get on to it at once, sir."
Hearing a murmur of voices in the library as he passed, Inspector Neil looked in. Whether Miss Marple had been looking for him or not, she was now fully engaged talking to Mrs. Percival Fortescue, while her knitting needles clicked busily. The middle of the sentence which Inspector Neil caught was,
"I have really always thought it was a vocation you needed for nursing. It certainly is very noble work."
Inspector Neil withdrew quietly. Miss Marple had noticed him, he thought, but she had taken no notice of his presence. She went on in her gentle, soft voice.
"I had such a charming nurse looking after me when I once broke my wrist. She went on from me to nurse Mrs. Sparrow's son, a very nice young naval officer. Quite a romance, really, because they became engaged. So romantic, I thought it. They were married and were very happy and had two dear little children."
Miss Marple sighed sentimentally.
"It was pneumonia, you know. So much depends on nursing in pneumonia, does it not?"
"Oh, yes," said Jennifer Fortescue. "Nursing is nearly everything in pneumonia. Though, of course, nowadays M&B sulphur works wonders, and it's not the long protracted battle it used to be."
"I'm sure you must have been an excellent nurse, my dear," said Miss Marple. "That was the beginning of your romance, was it not? I mean, you came here to nurse Mr. Percival Fortescue, did you not?"
"Yes," said Jennifer. "Yes, yes, that's how it did happen."
Her voice was not encouraging, but Miss Marple seemed to take no notice.
"I understand. One should not listen to servants' gossip, of course. But I'm afraid an old lady like myself is always interested to hear about the people in the house. Now, what was I saying? Oh, yes, there was another nurse at first, was there not? And she got sent away, something like that. Carelessness, I believe."
"I don't think it was carelessness," said Jennifer. "I believe her father or someone was desperately ill, and so I came to replace her."
"I see," said Miss Marple. "And you fell in love, and that was that. Yes, very nice indeed, very nice."
"I'm not so sure about that," said Jennifer Fortescue. "I often wish..."
Her voice trembled.
"I often wish I was back in the wards again."
"Yes, yes, I understand. You were keen on your profession."
"I wasn't so much at the time, but now when I think of it, life's so monotonous, you know. Day after day with nothing to do, and Val so absorbed in business.